The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have so much to talk about. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor Rob Dunn. He's a professor of biology at North Carolina State University. We're going to talk about the wild jungle living in our bodies and our obsession with cleanliness and its long-term health risks. You'll find that interesting in the second part of our program. A special in-depth discussion about vaccines as cluster bombs from Rowan Contrehoe from WordPress.com. Our issue of the day is going to come from Lynn Dine, Mugged Then Shot, from Common Dreams. Also today, time permitting, 18 points to escape the corporate matrix for all of you wanting to do something good and don't know where to start, how to make a difference rather than being depressed or apathetic. There's a lot of good things we can do. I'll give you 18 points to get you started. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. From Science Daily, the Journal of Clinical Oncology, new work on calcium plus vitamin D together can reduce melanoma risks in women. Now, we know that melanoma is a life-threatening skin cancer. This new research from Stanford University School of Medicine shows that if we start using 1,000 milligrams of calcium, they were only using 400 international units of vitamin D. I would suggest they go up to 2,000 international units of vitamin D and 1,000 milligrams from calcium, but the best form of calcium they weren't using. The best form is citrate, C-I-T-R-A-T-E. Then you can help prevent a deadly cancer. Also, for those of you who have Alzheimer's or know someone who has Alzheimer's, there's new research on cinnamon, and a cinnamon bark extract can slow the onset of Alzheimer's, according to Israeli researchers who studied its effect in mice and fruit flies after taking inspiration from a biblical passage. Blessed are the insects, blessed are the rodents. Terrible story, well, but that's where it begins. This was done at the Department of Zoology, Tel Aviv University. And so now it's helping. Now, why would it help? Well, because all of us in the field of health know that cinnamon helps with diabetes. Cinnamon, along with chromium picolinate, and will make an enormous difference. Cinnamon has enormous ORAC, or antioxidant activity in the body. Also helps stabilize blood sugar. So by giving it to a person with Alzheimer's, you're helping flood the brain with antioxidants and turn off inflammation. An inflammatory response in the brain is one of the reasons that people develop the plaques in the brain, the amyloid plaques that are indicative of Alzheimer's. So cinnamon, my suggestion, take cinnamon capsules, easy way to take it, or put cinnamon into your health shake. That's another good way to take it, but get it into your body each day. I'm asked all the time about diabetes. After all, we have an epidemic in the United States of diabetes and worldwide. In fact, the latest research that I just read this morning shows that of the $2.3 trillion that we spend in our national health care bill, it is estimated that upwards of one-fourth of that is spent on diabetes and its complications. The average American life expectancy is now dropping in many areas because of this whole diabetes complex. Remember, when you have diabetes, you're more likely to have heart disease, cancer, arthritis, and depression, all of which in and themselves lower the life expectancy. So we have an obesity diabetes epidemic in the United States. It's costing billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So the question is, can it be reversed? The answer is yes, it can. We've done it many times. And now there's new research that came out from Britain's Newcastle University. They reduced the caloric intake in people's diets to 600 calories a day, reduced fat levels, and found that it made a difference in the pancreas and liver. Let me quote this. Quote, "A new study suggests an extreme 8-week diet can reverse type 2 diabetes in people newly diagnosed with the disease. The researchers at Britain's Newcastle University found the 600-calorie-a-day diet reduced fat levels in the pancreas and liver, which helped insulin production return to normal. 7 out of 11 people who went on the diet, eating only liquid diet drinks and non-starchy vegetables, were free of diabetes 3 months later." All right, that's extreme. Most people are not going to be able to stay with that. It was like the Pritikin program. Nathan Pritikin, who was the apostle for a low 10% calories and fat diet. Try to get 10% of your diet as fat and nothing more. You're going to almost be raw and in vegetables and fruits only. I suggest 20% of our calories from healthy fats. After all, if you're eating coconut oil, that's a healthy fat. Avocados, walnuts, almonds, pistachios, macadamia nuts. Very good to eat a handful of macadamia nuts. Those are all good fats. And many other foods have good fats in them. But when you put someone on a diet, you don't want them just to go on and have some temporary benefit. You want them to be able to live on it. And the only diet worth being on is one that you can stay on easily, indefinitely, a sustainable diet. I find that by giving people 3 meals a day, the first one liquid, but load it with a high-quality protein, but don't go overboard. The most protein that anyone should really have beginning their day, including bodybuilders and weightlifters and athletes, myself included, would be 30 grams, preferably from non-genetically engineered material. I suggest a combination of brown rice, NP, and hemp, or non-genetically engineered soy. Those are all good sources. Now, then you can also, if you're underweight, and if you need some really 4 or 5 hours of stabilizing your blood sugar, put in some quality fat, like coconut oil, tablespoon, and flaxseed oil. Also put in maybe a couple tablespoons of your favorite nut butters, like almond butter, sunflower seed butter, sesame seed butter, tahini, all very good. Not a lot of good lignans in there, which help your immune system. Then throw in some fresh fruit or fruit concentrate or powdered fruit, and that gives you a full spectrum of phytonutrients, antioxidants, and proper ORAC. That's what really repairs DNA. See, the key to slowing down and reversing the aging process is you've got to have on a daily basis, ideally 6 times a day. That's the ideal. I look at everything in life as a curve. It's just like when I was recently talking about what do you do if you have concerns about the environment. Like, start at the beginning of a curve and say, okay, what can I do without moving? And then you start, what can you do there? And then you get a generator. They're not expensive. They're easy to get. Well, if I live in the suburbs, what if my electricity goes out for 3 months? Now, on that curve, if we do not have electrical surge protectors in place, they're about the size of a washing machine. They cost about $55,000, and we need about minimal 5,000 of them. So you're only talking about $250 million. That's nothing compared to the $2 to $3 trillion we will lose if our power grid is not protected and if electrical storms come, electromagnetic storms, and that plasma wave off the sun, which will come. It's not every scientist in the world who studies this knows that the sun gives off on a cyclic basis 11 to 12 years these storms. but normally they hit the Earth's outer magnetic shield and dissipate off into space, no problem. Occasionally a little bit gets in, again, no major problem. But this time we have a hole 5 times wider than the planet Earth, and big problem. Well, on a curve, where's the problem? It may be not so bad, knocking some power out here and there for a short period of time. Okay. Last year, people in Connecticut, including listening to this audience, had their power in some areas knocked out for about 12 days. Other people had power. So you have to look at everything in life on a curve. Everything. So on the good side of this curve, on the low end, okay, so it knocked a little bit out, you get back on. But what if it stays off? What if they didn't have the surges? What if, even though Congress approved financing for this, the utilities were opposed to it, and the Senate Republicans were opposed to it, so it hasn't gone through yet. So what if they get it done too late and too little? Then you get a good big propane tank, not a little tiny tank, a tank that gives you a measurement based upon how much you're using, that goes directly into a generator. Now you don't have an oil or diesel or a gas-fueled compressor that's a generator. You have propane directly in. Well, now you can go 6 months, a year, even if no one else has electricity, you will. What if you want to make sure that all your electricity in your house and computers don't get burned out with a surge, because that can also happen if they're on at the time? You get a surge protector. They're not expensive. Generally, for a really high-quality one, for an average suburban home, they might run you in the neighborhood of about $2,000 to $3,000. Sure is worth it. So for a relatively small amount of money, even a large tank will run you maybe about $2,000. And they come, they get the permits, they put it in the ground. So I look at everything on a curve. Disease, our activism, our body politics, cause and effect. Where are we on this curve? That tells us what we've got to do proactively. Some people automatically are more motivated. They want to be healthier. They want to do more. So if you're one of those people, say, Gary, on this curve, and if the bottom of the curve is disease and the end of that big R curve is ideal health, I want to be over there off the chart. I want to be so healthy that that all my cells are just firing the way they should. Okay, then you've got to have your antioxidants 6 times a day. You've got to have your phytonutrients, especially the red fruits, because the phytonutrients, the chemicals in that fruit, is what actually repairs the DNA. A little bit is good for your health, but will not repair the damage. You have to compensate. So understand everything is on a scale of need. And the body, when you're sick, needs a lot more than what we're giving it. So can we reverse diabetes by improving the diet, giving the big shake in the morning, having a good meal at lunch, having a smaller meal in the mid-afternoon, and a small meal in the evening? You bet. Can we do this by having not too much protein, which would damage the kidneys, which frequently is damaged in a person with diabetes? Absolutely. And the protein coming from non-animal sources is generally better utilized, high in fiber, and doesn't have the toxins and the urea and ammonium from meat and dairy and eggs and fish, which cause kidney and liver damage. Now, amino acids are the building blocks of protein. So the amino acids from a steak and the amino acids from a cup of brown rice are virtually identical, but how they get into the body is different. When you eat a steak, you're going to have to cook it in order to at least have it healthy enough you don't end up with a bacterial parasitic infection. The process of cooking that meat means now that it's going to be difficult to break down in the stomach and in the body. It also means you're bringing a whole lot of pro-inflammatory chemicals into the body. Those are called heterocyclic amines, bad for you. Have a brown rice, no heterocyclic amines. All good. A steak, mostly bad. So how you get your nutrition in as a diabetic is important, not just to maintaining blood sugar. It's relatively easy to do, but having all your other organs healthy in the process. And finally, junk food destroys brain cells. Boy, have I been waiting for this study. This is from the University of Washington in Seattle. published in Diabetes and Obesity. And here's what it says. Quote, a study has found that eating too much fatty junk food destroys brain cells that control weight, leading to a vicious circle of obesity. Researchers fed rats what they describe as a typical high-fat diet of Americans and found they had doubled their caloric intake in just 3 days. They also showed that there was inflammation in the hypothalamus, the part of the brain containing neurons that control body weight. And so that's one of the reasons when you're eating junk food, you're aging prematurely and you're creating a cycle of obesity. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'm going to be playing some of the Earth, Wind, and Fire as our music breaks, because I saw them in concert last night at the Beacon Theater. It was a packed house, and they rocked. They were wonderful, absolute perfection, not just in their songs and the voices, but in their manners, their presentation, the connection with the audience. It was a love fest. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to get out for a couple hours and enjoy what makes New York great, its culture, and see some people who have been around for 40 years. They're celebrating their 40th year, and they've had a lot of hits over there. I mean, they played a lot of those hits, and they just kept coming. Now, upcoming guests, we're going to have tomorrow Jeff Matrick, former economic columnist from the New York Times and a professor at Cooper Union. He'll discuss how we now live in an age of greed that has gradually emerged since the 1970s and contributing to our social and political decline. And then we're going to look at the evidence around the world that a new geography of violence is emerging that directly is a result of climate change. This you won't want to miss. Economist and fellow at the Nation Institute, Christian Parente, will share his investigations into every continent on how we are entering a new age of chaos as global warming further stresses our resources and population. Then we have the Australian oncologist, Dr. Robert Corder, who has created a very new non-toxic approach to treating cancer. And we also are going to be doing a special next week, a week from today, on the most astute look at chemtrails in Europe and the United States, their relationship to nanotechnology, their health risks associated with weather patterns, much more. And then Arne Gunderson, former engineer for many years in the nuclear power industry and one of the most outspoken opponents against nuclear power, will be our guest to talk about the latest updates on nuclear blowback we are witnessing today in the corrupting system of the energy industry. Gives you an idea of who we've got coming. Now, here is our issue of the day. I'm going to share it, and I'd like for you to call in and share your points of view, which I always enjoy listening to. This is from Lindin, D-I-N-H, called Mugged, Then Shot, from CommonDreams.org. Quote, if absolute power corrupts absolutely, why shouldn't the United States be the most corrupt and corrupting country on earth? We're number one. In America, each politician can be bought, and absurd sums of money are routinely misallocated or missing altogether, with nary a peep from the corrupt, complicit media. On the foreign front, America's modus operandi is to bribe every dictator, and the ones she can't bribe she'll undermine, overthrow, or bomb back to Jesus. In exchange for this bribe, which can be disguised as loans or foreign assistance, said dictator will allow America to loot their country in perpetuity. If you don't believe me, just strip any tin pot dictator and you'll surely see CIA tattooed on one ass cheek, with a pretty good portrait of a recent U.S. president embossed on the other. Well, sometimes it's not a dictator per se that we bribe, but a dominant party that's America's hush puppy. In any case, rapacious trade deals and unpayable loans are the bane of countless client states orbiting Washington. Domestically, American corruption has been institutionalized as campaign contributions and lobbying, but that's only the open legal part. Perhaps these practices are allowed to trick us into thinking that American corruption only goes so far. But who really knows how what goes on in the back rooms and basements and dungeons of Washington? In any case, as lumpen Americans are represented by millionaire politicians who are lent deep in the pockets of the fastest, fattest banks and corporations, the American politician is thoroughly corrupt. And we all know that, often from grassroots level on, but the degree of venality and sanctimonious hypocrisy increase as that politician approaches Washington, D.C., that beautiful cesspool of marital madness. No candidate who's not heavily big pro-business, overtly or covertly, can have any chance of being elected to national office. He won't be funded, nor will be seen on television. It's not a democracy when all candidates are vetted beforehand and only millionaires can be chosen by other millionaires and billionaires. In this setup, the average citizen doesn't matter, as his vote or canvassing for a favorite are only charades designed to make him feel good and involved, as his opinions and advocacy matter, but they don't. It wouldn't prevent the election of yet another tool who's corrupt if we became aware of those who are pro-war and pro-business at the expense of all else. That's what Democrats and Republicans all line up. Now, they'll tell you otherwise, but we all know they lie. They're pathological liars. How many times have we heard the Democrats say, we're there for pro-union, but then they created NAFTA. We're there to help the poor, but then they got social welfare programs. We're there to see that you get health care, but there's no health care in the health care bill that they passed. There's no prevention. Do they think we're all insane? Must be. And then we have Obama. It's a win-win-lose-lose situation, you see, because everyone wants their favorite guy to win. Well, in this kind of campaigning, those who voted for McCain, for example, got pretty much all of his policy through Obama. Emblematic of this farce is the fact that American taxpayers are even asked to contribute $3 a year to the Presidential Election Campaign Fund, though stuffed with cash from Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and Raytheon, our candidates still panhandle from poor schmucks, whom they still soon rip off anyway. American politicians may differ on personal and ethical matters such as school prayer, gay marriage, and abortion, but let's face it, on all major lucrative issues affecting the military-industrial complex or big business, they are remarkably uniform. Our senators and congressmen also behave like trained seals when it comes to Israel. Witness the 29 standing ovations a packed house gave Netanyahu recently. Whether Democrat or Republican, each was terrified to be caught sitting as his colleagues jumped up and barked. Your rep sure knows who his daddy is and who it ain't. You sucker. The primary job of the American politician from Obama on down is to spin and disguise an endless series of corporate military crimes he's enabling. Which brings us to the Pentagon. No other governmental organ is more gluttonously corrupt. Corrupt at every level. The Pentagon's main function is not defending America. That is a joke, and you're too smart to believe that. But to bleed this country dry to enrich Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and the rest. Over and over again. And to do it mockingly right in front of you. The Pentagon has put hundreds of thousands of Americans in harm's way just so its masters can make a handsome profit. To feed those insatiable gorgs, the Pentagon is willing to destroy America itself and is doing so right now. Besides bloody business as usual, billions of dollars often go missing from the Pentagon cash register without any explanation or anyone held accountable. For example, in 2001, Donald Rumsfeld even admitted that $2.3 trillion had disappeared, which he blamed on sloppy bookkeeping. So it's not thievery or corruption, but merely inept arithmetic. Tampering down this scandal, the mainstream media seem to agree. But perhaps we do have a math problem. We are people who clip 25-cent coupons, drive a mile to save a buck, register with subtle satisfaction the missing penny from a 1999 price tag, yet these stolen trillions leave us unfazed, unmoved. One reason for this, I think, is that American corruption is not experienced directly face-to-face as it is in many other countries. Most Americans have never been browbeaten and shaken down by a corrupt cop, a clerk, or a judge, so we can pretend that corruption doesn't hurt us. Washington has also been waging wars without raising taxes, so it's no skin off my back, many Americans are thinking, but our bellicose policy overseas is certainly bankrupting the homeland, even if it increases our insecurity and future blowbacks. The constant hike in our money supply, devaluing our dollars, is also a form of hidden taxation. In conclusion, another reason for our passivity in the face of widespread corruption is the state of our media, which routinely hype trivial stories while suppressing much greater outrages. Thus, the money John Edwards spent on his mistress, $1 million provided by two private donors, was discussed for a week by television newspaper pundits, but no one is concerned about $1.5 million of tax money wasted each time Washington fires a Tomahawk missile at Libya. How many thousands have been launched so far in this three-month war? No one knows, and no one seems to care about the real flesh and bones on the receiving end of these weapons. Bad guys deserve to die, we're told, and so collateral damage might happen, but we don't put a face on collateral damage. We don't want to acknowledge the suffering we've caused over the war. Even as these mugs are there, our masters speak to us as if we're morons. As they gobble up the entire world and everyone's future, we get to nibble on catchphrases and slogans. Ain't it nice? Like Pavlov's dogs, Americans have been conditioned to salivate at the sound of a home run, a Lady Gaga's burp, and the promise of hope and change coming election time. But when that flat, familiar hand reaches into our wallet yet again, we feel nothing. We're cool and blasé until it's our turn to receive the pink slip, be evicted, then having to curl up in our car or on cardboard. Interviewed by Studs Terkel's, retired Congressman C. Wright Patman said in 1970, "A dictatorship could spring up here overnight. If this country got so bad, if another depression came, we'd have a revolution. People wouldn't take it anymore. They have more knowledge, the big ones. They'd be looking for somebody that had the power just to kill people if they didn't agree with them. When John Doe begins to get up, they'd just go down and shoot him," unquote. I'm not sure that we have more knowledge today, but with a presidency that can wage wars without Congress or popular approval and that can imprison or kill any American citizen at whim or will without any due process, a dictatorship is certainly here, ditto that depression. In a productive economy, corruption is less glaring because there are so many legitimate ways to enrich oneself, but an increasingly non-productive one, such as what we have now, corruption becomes the primary means to riches. As we starve and kill each other, the mega corporations and their servants, our politicians and media, will continue to fatten themselves through their access to power. In a ghetto with no stores, only drug corners, any dude steering a loud Hummer is viewed suspiciously or with admiration. So in this nation of fewer and fewer factories, save those that make bombs, tanks, and high-grade weapons or pharmaceuticals, who are our biggest death pushers and pimps, and what should we do about them? End quote. Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. My guest in 12 minutes coming at us is Professor Rob Dunn. And we're going to talk about hygiene inside the body. I remember when I was growing up, my mom allowed us to play in the dirt. I remember eating dirt. We all did as kids. Gee whiz, how we ever survive. Well, what it might be called is natural immunity. We'll get to that. Back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us. Wow. welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Joining me in studio is Elizabeth. Elizabeth reads the emails at askgary@garynoll.com and then asks questions or makes comments. I'm going to go to your calls in just a second here. But I promised you 18 points to escape the corporate matrix. This is the positive information that we need. These are the tools of self-empowerment. Yes, these problems are bad, but as bad as these problems are, I want you to have good solutions. Here we go with these. First, avoid purchasing any clothing manufactured outside the United States. It must be made in America, and preferably by the Women's International Long Garment Industry Union. So at least these women are making a living wage, and we're supporting Made in America. If it's not Made in America, don't buy it. Secondly, support your local produce, goods, and services, farmers markets, and transition to buying organic only. Boycott purchasing food from any major supermarket chain, especially Walmart and Whole Foods. Support smaller local food markets. Boycott all genetically modified foods by demanding the food be properly labeled for containing genetically modified ingredients or having been irradiated. No irradiated food should be purchased. No genetically modified food should be purchased. Shift your savings and checkings to local savings and loan banks after you've asked them basic questions. Do you engage in credit default swaps and derivatives? What are your standards? What is your percentage of loans against your reserves? Support small quality banks and credit unions run like state banks. These do not engage in these rampant derivative and exotic investment instruments. Remove all funds from Citibank, Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo, etc. Become a socially responsible investor and divest yourself of any corporate and financial and institutional activities that exploit labor and the environment. And for all of you who are government employees, state or federal and local, ask your pensions, have they invested, for example, in hedge funds that are buying farmers' land in Africa and displacing farmers to speculate on the food that will be a major instrument for them to make profit in the future? That is a bad way to make money. That's hurting people in other countries. Become aware of where your money is being invested. And if it's not being invested ethically and morally and honorably, take it out. And approach the people at the meetings and raise hell and make an issue. Purchase organic bedding and install toxic-free carpeting, or get rid of the carpeting and get down to wood and tile and flooring. So that helps you, and also you hire local people to do it. So you detoxify your home and go green at the same time. Adopt alternative forms of transportation that might include more walking and bicycling to curtail excessive and unnecessary use of your cars and vehicles. Become socially engaged by protesting mandatory vaccines and subscribe to progressive watch organizations devoted to mobilizing citizens to protect congressional and state bills that only benefit corporations, like in New Jersey. New Jersey and New York are arm wrestling champions, the most corrupt states in America. They're vying to see if they can be as corrupt as Mexico or Iraq. And I wouldn't trust any politician in any state, a curse on all of their houses, because these are the lowest of the low in New York and New Jersey. And so don't trust anything that they try to sell you on. We have a moratorium on hydrofracking in New York. Don't just accept that. Get out information on how dangerous it is for that hydrofracking and gas leasing and how that can pollute the air and water in a given area. Because we all know how corrupt the politicians are. And the moment your back's turned, boom, it slides right through again. So become more aware. Kind of visualize when you go to Albany that you are the Roto-Rooter person and you're going in to clean out a septic system, because that's all Albany is. It's a bunch of crappy politicians in a giant toilet bowl. I don't care what you spray on them. They're still going to smell like they are. Next, vote with your conscience, not your fears. Get complete voting records and corporate funding histories of any politician in any election to become aware of what they have actually done in the past. And only support progressive candidates for all offices who are truly looking after all the people's interests, not the rich and the special interests. Become engaged in your communities to organize and support anti-foreclosure referendums. Get it on the referendum. Stop foreclosures in your state. You can do that if you organize. and reform to improve rental policies. Right now, the landlords own Albany. That's why we have draconian laws that do not help small businesses or you, the renter. Help initiate and support community barter services where individuals can sign up and provide their talents and time when available to share on a non-currency-based exchange. So right now you're unemployed, you're underemployed, but you've got talent. So sign up. Let people know what are your talents, what can you can do, and then organize it so that one person could have 1,000, 10,000 people. So anyone who needs any service at all, you've got a whole list of people that you can get, and then you can exchange services. Donate whatever is not necessary to your life, to such as unused clothing and home items to the poor. Engage in community service. Become engaged with those in need of kindness and compassion in your communities. Now, this might be acting as a big brother or big sister for orphans or parentally deprived children. It might be helping senior citizens, helping them with their shopping or banking or transportation. But a lot of times senior citizens are afraid to go out. They're afraid of being mugged, which they frequently are. But they still have to go out and be that person that takes them to the park for a walk. Help them. They're a human being. Let them see that you care about them. Support cooperative community projects, the Rent-A-Couch movement, and help create proper screening for people to live temporarily in converted, unused spaces until they can get back on their feet. This can be converted garages, basements, and attics, and adjacent buildings on a property for a modest rent and barter. Get referendums that all federal, state, and county properties that are not being used should be converted over to inexpensive living for the homeless. If we did that, we could get 5 million homeless people a place to live. And demand by referendum that abandoned buildings and properties owned by the government and states or local townships be converted into parks, recreational center, drug rehabilitation, and counseling centers. We have all the tools we need. We just don't have the political will to do it. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go over now and say hello to, well, we got Lou Anne on the line. Hi, Lou Anne.
Hi, Gary. And hi, everyone. I just wanted to come on today and mention very quickly that I don't know if people realize this, but one of the great ways to generate revenue in this economy is to have your own home-based business. And I know that a lot of your audience is familiar with it, but I know we also have a lot of new people listening in.
Well, I'm a big believer in home-based businesses because that way you can do something rather than nothing, and a lot of times you can get income coming in you wouldn't otherwise have. Lou Anne, I'm running a little behind here. Can you just give your phone number? People would like to reach
sure.
out to you.
If anyone wants information, email me at WHNN, William Harry Nancy Nancy, WHNN@AOL.com, or you can call me at 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198. And I'll get you all the information you need so you can start generating some extra income.
Okay, and also this coming Sunday I'm going to do another telephone conference and a lecture, not a lecture, I'm going to do a discussion only for those people who are interested in doing a homesteading project. I'm now in the process of starting because it's about 3 months out that I'm going to actually be bringing homesteaders in. I've gone ahead and made that next step. So I'll be interviewing people only for doing homesteading. The other projects are still sometime in the future, but homesteading takes about 3 months to prepare. People, let them call you. Give your phone number, Lou Anne.
631-504-6198. And while I'm sitting here, I'm...
What is it?
631-504-6198.
Thank you, Lou Anne. Let's say hello to Joe from Bronx. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Gary. How are you? I wanted to just make a maybe briefly a question here based on your commentary just a few minutes ago. With 9 billion people on this planet, why is it that we cannot improve this world with all that human potential?
Okay,
what is holding us back?
Pull back your number a bit to a little under 7 billion.
Okay.
But your question's a completely valid one, and I appreciate you for asking it. It's because of the people who control all systems. The people who control a system first are rewarded for maintaining the control of everyone else who's in that system. So as long as you're in a system, a medical system, a financial system, educational system, a business system, a governmental system, you have to abide by the rules. If you don't abide by the rules, even if the rules are self-serving to only a small group of people and don't help everybody, you have to convince everybody that there's only one set of rules, one set of laws are going to be equally applied, everyone's going to benefit, and then people see, would you whiz, why is it that I don't have the food I need, I don't have the seeds to plant, you're giving me a suicide seed, you're giving me what's called a terminator seed by Monsanto, it only grows once, and we're used to growing seeds and saving them the next year, how does that help me? And Monsanto then immediately sends in organizations through the corrupt World Trade Organization and the equally vile UN on its seed bank program and says, but you're getting great advantage. What advantage? And unfortunately, the average person or 95% of the people in the world have no power over any institution or any of the individuals in those institutions or rules or regulations within those systems. So until such time that you have a policymaker working on your behalf inside an institution, then all we hear are what were promised but never delivered and why it will come in the future, providing we don't throw people out of power. Our problem is we should throw everyone out of power. At every level, in every institution, and stop believing in any institution, all institutions, until there's not reform. I don't believe in reform. I believe reform is a mind-numbingly stupid concept. I believe in transformation. If you want real change, transform the problem. If you want to adapt to the lowest common denominator at the bottom of a curve, reform the institution. We've had tons of reform. None of it has made a difference. We reformed the Glass-Steagall Act. It opened the way for massive looting of our economy. We reformed Medicare. It allows companies, pharmaceutical companies, to charge upwards of 500,000% profit that they make on a product. So don't go for the people in power. Just look at them. Don't listen to what they say. Look at what they've done. Judge someone by what they've done and what the world is because of what they've done. Then pull back the power. Don't vote for them. That's what I'm saying. Don't buy their products. Don't live where they tell you to live. Do everything the opposite of what they're telling you, and that's how we take back our power, all right? Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary.
In studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We've had a daughter who's called in. She's the daughter of a couple. They live in Arizona. She said that her and her four siblings just last night took their parents out to celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary with a dinner. And in the course of this dinner, your name came up. The mother talked about how she came to your lecture in Phoenix, Arizona in the early 70s.
I did not have sex with that woman. I don't think. Was she tall, blonde?
Yes.
Very voluptuous?
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay. In the early 70s, at the time you were everywhere on TV. You were on Johnny Carson and all sorts of other shows, all the most famous of them. You were at the Civic Center, and 7,000 people came to see you. It was the most audience, before or after, for anyone who'd ever given a health lecture before. She was saying that you had long dark hair, you're wearing a white suit and a white t-shirt. You rocked their world, you had them laughing. It was meant to be for 1 hour, but it went on for 3 hours. And this lecture changed their mum's life. When she came back home, she started to throw out all the garbage, and she soon had everyone on a very healthy diet and on a supplementation program, all except for her father, who didn't believe in health. And anyway, lots of arguments had followed in their household in the course of this. Her mum had to make the father a separate meal for breakfast, lunch and dinner. But, however, when the father was 52, he had a heart attack and his arteries were clogged, and the mum then insisted that he change his life. Now the father is 81 and very healthy. The mother is 79 and she looks 55, this lady's saying. She has enormous energy. She works every day. She made it clear at this dinner last night that her and her father would not be alive today if they'd not followed your heart disease protocol. Now they recognize for the first time, the daughter who's calling it, recognized for the first time that where other parents living in assisted living or they have diseases, her parents are very healthy. They listen to your show every day. They walk 5 miles a day, and they bike for half an hour, and sometimes they do weights. They're very healthy, so this lady wanted to say from her and her brothers and sisters, thank you for allowing them to enjoy their parents and their parents' good health for all this long.
Well, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's now standing by. I will do my vaccine report tomorrow. And just one quick little note here. And I also have one on How Greed Destroys America by Robert Perry coming up. But the cost of the war, U.S. cost of the war, as of this morning, $3.7 trillion and counting. This is according to the latest report from the group that monitors this. It's the Brown University Watson Institute for International Studies, say, quote, that the final bill will run over $3.7, probably up to $4.4 trillion, and that does not take into account 224,000 people who have died directly due to the warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan, of which 125,000 are just in Iraq, just civilians, not including the 365,000 who have died from other causes like loss of clean water, health care, nutrition, and those who've been wounded, and 7.8 million people, equal to the combined population of Connecticut and Kentucky, that have been displaced. Quote, cost of war, which is a new report just out this morning, brought together from 20 academics to uncover the expense of war in lives and dollars. That's a daunting task, and I just might add this. Go back and look at all the excuses that people gave for why we should be in Iraq, and how bad Saddam Hussein was. Well, yeah, he was bad. But now, remember when people are saying, well, you know, he's killed over 3,000 of his own people? Yeah, that's bad. Well, this report says we've killed 125,000 civilians in Iraq. Why isn't anyone in the media talking about this? And the fact that we will have spent $3.7 trillion. That's just a little side. Let's go to my guest, Professor Rob Dunn, professor of biology at North Carolina State University. His research focuses on the interface between various organisms, and particularly humans and other species, and their relationship to disease and illness. And what's novel, at least from my perspective, Professor Dunn's research, is his openness to challenge the assumptions science makes about the roles and functions of organisms surrounding us, and the willingness to state that there is much we don't know. And besides many of his peer-reviewed publications, and he's written for many other groups, his most recent book, The Wild Life of Our Bodies. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here today, Gary. Real pleasure. Hi both to you and all the species on you.
Thank you. I think we should begin, please, by debunking the common and pervading myth that humanity is somehow designed to control nature rather than partake of nature on nature's terms. And it's quite evident that in polarizing relationships modern society has built with the natural world has brought us a huge challenge, now endangering the lives of not only people but numerous other organisms and species. So as an evolutionary biologist, take us through, please, and I will not interrupt you. I want you to really lay it out for us, this complex relationship, the symbiotic pattern that has been created between humans and other organisms, especially microbes, since they are numerous bacteria and organisms that live in our body, and share with us more about the mutual beneficial partnerships we have with these little creatures, which has made our own bodies like a wild jungle.
Well, thank you. So if we think about our lineage, not just the human lineage, but our longer lineage, For essentially the entirety of our evolutionary history, we've interacted with lots of other species. Among the first multicellular organisms were parasites. And so our life as humans, as living organisms, is a life that for most of that entirety, the vast, vast majority, has been intricately part of this relationship with predators, with parasites, with mutualists, which is to say species that our lineage benefited and that we benefited from, and there's lots of hangers-on. And really in the last 100 and 150 years or so, we've begun to really dramatically change both our relationship to other species and our perception of our relationship to other species. And I would say they've both changed really phenomenally. And so it wasn't long ago at all that predation was a really important selective pressure on humans, that many humans died from being eaten. And if we go further back, it wasn't long ago that our ancestors were about the size of a Big Mac, and they were eaten by eagles, they were eaten by snakes, they were eaten by other things. And so we have this history of interacting with other species. But now we're in this weird moment in time when we view ourselves as isolated from nature, as being in control of nature. And in fact, what we've instead done is just to create a very different kind of nature in which we've tried to exclude those things that we're conscious of. And so if you look historically, we first tried to exclude the predators. We killed them off. And so it's no, chance luck that many of the rarest vertebrates on Earth are big predators, tigers, leopards, cheetahs. We consciously tried to kill them off. Then we started to kill off pests, things in our agriculture. And then when we realized that there were germs in our bodies, we went into open war, and war, I think, is not an appropriate word there, against the species living on us and in our societies. And there are moments in each of those stories when it wasn't the wrong decision to try to repel those species. You know, if your baby's sitting in front of your cave and there are leopards all around, it's in fact a very natural thing to try to defend your baby from that leopard. But in each of these stories, as time has gone on, we've learned more about which species benefit us and which don't. And so there then becomes a point in each of these stories when we need balance. We need to think about not just how to disfavor bad species, but also how to favor good ones. And so what I argue for in this new book, Wildlife of Our Bodies, is that we need to rethink these interactions with other species. We need to learn about them. We need to study them. We need to think about how to treat ourselves in the context of those interactions. And we need to create a world not just where we repel bad species, but also where we favor good species. And I've studied ants for many years, in addition to studying human interactions with other species. And there's a whole lineage of ants that farms fungus. And in many ways, they're a lot like human farmers. But one of the really strange things about those ants relative to us is that they farm where they live. They grow the species that are good for them near them. We are the only species that I'm aware of on Earth that's chosen to put all the species that are good for us far away, these factory farms at a great distance from where we live, and to allow near us in our lives mostly those species that sneak past. And so we get bed bugs, we get pathogens that make it past our antibiotics. And so that's really what the book is about. You asked me to go along, and I can talk forever, Gary, so I'll stop now. But
I appreciate the overview. Let's take a look at something that's almost an obsession in the United States, avoiding germs and bugs. And drug makers and corporations are happy to perpetuate this myth to sell their products. Now, you've looked at this huge assault of different antibiotics and cleaning products and other materials designated to sterilize our world. At the same time, you've noted how this has also contributed to a dramatic increase in illnesses like Crohn's disease and asthma, new allergies and autism. So take us down that road, especially start with maybe antibiotic hand washers.
Yeah, so antibiotic hand washers are really an astounding phenomenon. If you look in the scientific literature on antibiotic hand creams or soaps or dish detergents are one of the places that are the most common. It's very hard to find a dish detergent that doesn't have antibiotics in it, mostly triclosan. 75% of adults use some form of antibiotic wipe or cream or soap in their lives. And so you would hope that we understand a lot about what those products are doing. And the truth is we really don't. But if you do look at what we know, there have been a number of good studies now that compare families that have been given, let's say, for example, antibiotic soap to those that have been given standard soap or sort of alcohol-based wipes. And if you look at a large population, what you tend to see is if you use just standard good old-fashioned soap, if you're in a high disease area, it can reduce the frequency of common illnesses in your family by as much as 40 or 50% just by washing with soap regularly.
You know,
it's a miraculous thing.
But one second. You know how difficult it is for many people to find just regular soap today, since the manufacturers have gotten the message that only the antibacterial soap should be sold. By the way, you're listening to Professor Rob Dunn, D-U-N-N. He is the author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies. Many of the stations are going off, and you can continue listening to this conversation on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. So please continue.
So if you then compare the normal use of sort of standard non-antibiotic soaps, which, as you point out, are no longer as standard as they once were, to people using the antibiotic soaps, for most people, you see similar results, maybe modestly worse disease control with the antibiotic soaps, which is amazing on its own, because what we're told is that those antibiotic soaps will save us. They'll make us clean. We'll never have anything growing on us. We'll be the best people in the world. But there's a recent study that then also looked at people with chronic disease. And so the diseases in the particular study were asthma, diabetes, and then a couple of others. And they were just participants who happened to have those diseases. And those participants, when they used the antibiotic soap, they were actually more likely than the control to get fevers, coughs, and other symptoms of common diseases. And so in that particular group, not only were the antibiotic soaps not doing better than standard soaps, they're actually making them sicker. And so it's interesting then to stop and think, well, what could be happening on our hands and bodies when we use these soaps? And so for background, all of your skin, everybody listening, is covered in bacteria. Bacteria, fungi, maybe some other interesting things, some mites on your forehead. And they're incredibly diverse. So we've been doing this project where we sample, Yuri Hulser and Andrew Lucky, my group, are leading this project where they sample belly button bacteria. And in looking at 100 people, we've found over 1,400 species of bacteria living in their belly buttons. 1,400. So there's incredible diversity that's living on people in cities, no matter where they live. But there are about 30 that are really common. And so what we think is going on is that these 30 are sort of our core partners in moving through the living world, and that they help to defend us from pathogens and do other important things on our skin. And that it may be that these antibiotic, so standard soap, what it does in that context is standard soap helps to wash off the occasional bad things that show up in addition to our normal bacteria. It may be that these antibiotic soaps, in addition to getting the transient bad things, are also starting to get our good bacteria and kill them. And they lead to resistance in some cases, and they're just bad news.
All right, my final question here, if you could. Give us an idea of what goes on in our intestines, because we have antibiotics in our meat, in our chicken and our fish, especially farm-raised fish, which is all your tilapia, much of your bass and trout and salmon, and lots of it in there because of the high concentration of fish that are grown together, and then they throw in the artificial coloring, they throw in the antibiotics. Much of that is passed through into our bodies. What happens when we get an overload from these exogenous bacteria, and then also get their parasites and get their antibiotics all coming into our body, and then think of the people who will take an antibiotic for almost anything? What does that do to upset that natural balance, and what can come from that?
So in the most severe cases, what can come is a really severe infection. And so Clostridium is difficile, is a bacteria that, if your gut fauna, if the forest that lives inside you gets wiped out, it will colonize happily your gut. Your gut is a wonderland of food, and the infections from that bacteria and also others are becoming more and more common, in part because of the overuse of antibiotics in many contexts, including our food, but also self-administered antibiotics. And so what's been happening more and more in hospitals is people are actually getting fecal transplants.
Fecal transplants? I thought only politicians did that.
No. They give us as much as we want, but it's not necessarily healthy feces. So what you – and this – I lost myself for a second there. But the, So what these fecal transplants are feces from healthy individuals, and they're either given as an enema or directly into the intestine via the nasal cavity. And so those transplants save lives, and the reason they save lives is because in people with these severe infections, the normal bacteria have been wiped out. A really cool evolutionary part of that story is it looks more and more like one of the reasons that our appendix exists, that useless thing that we cut out so readily, is that it may have been ancestrally kind of a storehouse for good bacteria. And so if you had a really bad infection, like from cholera, the bacteria could then recolonize your gut from the appendix. And so here's this sort of ancestral version of the fecal transplant that is part of our body. And so one of the things that I think is really amazing in thinking about something like the appendix is our conscious brains seem to keep telling us that a lot of the life around us is bad. We should get rid of it. You know, when the ant comes in your kitchen, kill it immediately with whatever pesticide you need. When you hear that you have bacteria in your belly button, scrub as hard as you can. Well, our subconscious parts of our body are providing different messages. And so our appendix may be favoring bacteria. IgA, which is this really common antibody in our guts, it's the most common one. For 40 years, it's been thought that the primary role of that antibody was to fight bacteria. It was in the fight, good fight with us. It was killing those bacteria. Well, it now looks like that sometimes is part of its role, if bacteria start to cross the gut wall. But far more often, its role is actually to help good bacteria form films of life along the walls of our gut. And so it essentially does them the favor of helping them to link together. And so while our conscious brains are making us use those wipes, those awful wipes at the grocery store, our subconscious bodies are helping the bacteria that we need, which I think is a really interesting circumstance that the dumb part of our body could be outsmarting the so-called smart part.
I appreciate your good work here. Thank you very much for giving us an insight. And more can be found by reading The Wild Life of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today, by Professor Rob Dunn. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Gary. Have a wonderful day.
All right. And that's it for today. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.